Well, good morning, everybody. Please be seated. This is the northern panel of the Nevada Supreme Court, Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons, and myself. Our first case this morning is case number 56973, Marshall versus District Court, Edward G. Marshall for the petitioners, Mr. David Frederick for the respondent. Mr. Marshall, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. My name is Edward Marshall. My bar number is 323. Good morning, distinguished members of the court. The temporary writ of prohibition, which was properly and justifiably issued in this case, should be made permanent. Judge Kadish must comply with the required statutory procedure of filing an affidavit, citing the specific acts by me that constituted contempt of court. And she must recuse herself from hearing that contempt citation because she is disqualified by the terms of the statute. The 1950 McCormick case and the 1990 AWOD case set forth the correct procedure, and they have not been overruled by the 2002 Humboldt River case. If they had been overruled, the Humboldt River case would have specifically said so. Incidentally, I request to reserve time for rebuttal.
Yes. How many?
Other time I do not
How much time?
Sir?
Did you want to reserve 5 minutes, as I would say?
I think so. That should be fine.
Go ahead.
The 1985 Brown case, found at 101 Nevada, 146, states that the court's inherent power is nevertheless bound by statute. And the statute clearly says that this procedure of disqualification is required where an objection is so made. In that case, the Brown case has never been overruled or superseded either. So the issue squarely stated is whether Judge Kadish must comply with the statutory procedure of NRS 22.030, subsection 3, or not. If the statute is no longer the law of this state, then the Humboldt River case should have clearly said so in 2002, and it did not. The Humboldt River case, found at 118 Nevada, 901, is really immaterial since it is specifically a criminal contempt case, not a civil contempt case, which this one is. The sentence in that case was 3 days jail as punishment, not to coerce performance of any act. The 200 case about Attorney Joseph Houston clearly shows that NRS 22.030, subsection 3, means exactly what it says: a written statement of the specific acts constituting the alleged contempt must be created by the judge. And if objection is filed, that judge must recuse herself. That decision is very relevant, because indeed, in this case, I filed not one, but two specific objections against Judge Kadish, as found at Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 4 of my petition for writ of prohibition. I have stated in our petition that never in 50 years of practicing law at this bar have I seen a judge so completely in the pocket of opposing counsel as Judge Kadish illustrated in this case. And there were at least three hearings set upon an order shortening time, which are extremely hard to come by. On these three occasions, I had to answer motions and make an appearance in court within less than 24 hours. And there was never any justified emergency for these issuance of these orders shortening time. The court should look at my objection shown at the Record on Appeal, page 1062 in volume 5, where I complained specifically to the judge about these orders shortening time. I said I was not notified of this hearing until 4 o'clock yesterday. Here I am without a chance to present anything in opposition. Everything is push, 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 run, 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 do it right now. That's not realistic. It can't be done that way. And I would once again request time to present points and authorities. On every one of those three occasions, I was overruled, and the matter proceeded immediately to hearing. The second point I wish to raise today is that the procedures authorized and permitted by Judge Kadish totally violated Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure. She should be required to take a refresher course in Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure. That book requires that a complaint be filed if you're dissatisfied with somebody's performance, and an answer be filed, and the matter proceeds to discovery of interrogatories, requests for admission, and so forth. I had a retaining lien on all of my work product files in this case. The retaining lien was against Mrs. Girth, who was present in the courtroom. Mrs. Girth had a proprietary interest in her files that were created during her tenure as trustee of the trust. She successfully defended the Iowa litigation and the Nevada litigation that was filed by the Fisher children, who always represented the primary threat in this case because of the fact that the one son of Colonel Fisher showed up on his deathbed at the hospital demanding and requesting that he sign certain documents putting all of his affairs in control of the son. Mrs. Girth did a prodigious amount of work to defend this trust from the Fisher children, who constituted the main threat. She defended two cases, one in Iowa, the other in Nevada, and to be ordered to turn over all of her records and files to the American Legion Council violated her rights and mine, since no provision was made for payment to her. If the Legion officials didn't like her performance, and we had consultations with them, and they were notified of what was done, they were given a chance to inspect our records, they were kept informed with at least 33 separate instances of correspondence, telephone calls, or other matter. If they didn't like her performance, they could have filed a complaint. They should have filed a complaint. Instead, they went to Judge Kadish, who summarily ordered that all of her files be turned over to them. And she still has not been paid for her services, nor have I been paid for my final services. That is a matter that is still in limbo. There was no legal authority for this illegal procedure by Judge Kadish. So we are asking the court, as unusual and strange as it may sound, to order that she and I have been paid since our legal rights have been violated, paid to the extent that we have been paid. And the Legion officials knew what they were doing when they obtained these files and destroyed our legal rights in those files. And this court should require that our demands for payment of services performed should be met. I have just one further point to make. We do not believe it was law. I'm sorry, that is not a correct statement. I'm a little bit farther. We do not believe it was lawful for Judge Kadish to order that all of the trustees' records be turned over to the new trustee absent some guarantee of payment for services. What happened was, plain and simple, they wanted our work product free. That was the bottom line. Incidentally, the answering brief alleges that I provided redacted copies of records only. That is not true. There is not one solitary redacted copy of records in this case. The records that went to the firm of Lionel Sawyer were my original files. And since in many cases those records had not been copied, we trusted that they would be copied as the court ordered and returned. Judge Kadish ordered that the records be surrendered, and that was done. They obtained our original records, and they were never returned as they had been surrendered. The list of records shown on the illegible receipt, Exhibit 5, to the original petition. If you can't read the receipt, you have no idea what was taken. And I can't read that receipt. I can read a few things in there. But the whole concept that an adverse attorney can invade my law office to search for records is outrageous. It is small wonder that we believe that Judge Kadish was biased in this case. And as we've indicated, counsel for the American Legion did not ever indicate specifically what they were looking for. I direct the court's attention to the Record of Appeal, page 868, in book 4, where I said to the court, the problem is that Mrs. Brookfield needs to specify specifically what she's looking for that wasn't there. Conduct of the American Legion has been outrageous. They sat back for a full 1 year, leaving me and Mrs. Gertz to defend and pursue their interests. They've contested just compensation. The request to the trust corpus to the Legion was completely unknown to them until Mrs. Gertz revealed it after Colonel Fisher died. They should be required to read a formal apology to Colonel Fisher at Arlington Cemetery. And I take that statement very seriously. Thank you very much.
Mr. Marshall, I just had one question. Are there any types of cases, in your opinion, your interpretation of the law, that the judge who enters the order can hear a contempt proceeding? Can you do that in family court? Or are there any exceptions to it? Or do you think if there's a contempt proceeding in any case, it has to go to a different judge?
The judge can hear the proceeding unless an objection is made. An objection has to be made.
Okay.
If it's not made, the judge has the power to proceed.
Okay, so if an objection is made, then it has to go to a different judge.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You have 3.5 minutes left. Mr. Frederick, on behalf of the respondent.
May it please the court. David Frederick, with me is Elizabeth Brookfield of Lionel Sawyer and Collins on behalf of the Real Party and Interest, China Post number 1 of the American Legion. The court's February 15th order asked us to specifically address the question whether NRS 22030 sub 3 applies in civil contempt hearings. Frankly, what I intend to address my argument here today is that question. Some of the matters about which Petitioner's Counsel spoke are reflected in the petition and in the briefing. They're fully answered in the briefing. I'll be happy to answer any questions on that regard, but otherwise, I intend to submit those matters to the court on the briefing that has already been made.
You're essentially asking us to overrule McCormick, correct?
No. I'm asking you to recognize its distinguishing features. I do not believe that this panel needs to overrule McCormick. What I do think this panel needs to do is recognize that in both factually and the legal background on which McCormick relies are, in the case of the legal background, no longer existent, and in both cases, not applicable to these proceedings. That, I think, provides grounds for distinguishing McCormick. Obviously, this court can overrule. I don't think it has to. Let me start, before I get to McCormick, with civil versus criminal contempt, not only because that's the subject of the issue framed by the court, but also because it provides the legal predicate, if you will, for what we believe is the limited applicability of NRS Chapter 22 in general and NRS 22030 sub 3 in particular to civil contempt proceedings. Criminal contempt, according to this court as well as others, is concerned with punishment. Civil contempt is concerned with inducing compliance with previously issued court orders. And that's most often true in circumstances where there are ongoing litigation proceedings. And that's certainly true in this case. What we are talking about here is a beneficiary's right to inspect and copy trust records.
I think the concession is this is coercive civil contempt. So the question is whether or not subparagraph 3 of 22010, disobedience or resistance to any lawful writ, order, rule, process, etc., is covered. And if it is covered in this case, and if McCormick applies, should it not apply because of separation of powers? I mean, that's where I see this argument going.
I agree with you completely. And that's where I'm headed. The reason why, when you have civil contempt in ongoing judicial proceedings, collides with 2203.0 sub 3 is separation of powers. This court, in a series of decisions, most if not all of which have been rendered since McCormick, has developed separation of powers and inherent power. And I use those words jointly because some of the court's decisions suggest that there may be a somewhat different doctrinal basis between separation of powers and inherent powers arising from the existence of the judiciary as a system within the governmental sphere. The reason why 22, in our opinion, 22030 sub 3 is not applicable in civil contempt proceedings that involve ongoing, that arise in the midst of ongoing judicial proceedings, is because this court has said repeatedly that the administration and management of ongoing judicial proceedings is within the judicial sphere of government, not within the legislative sphere. And it has said it in a number of cases. It has effectively recognized it without discussing it in at least one or two of the court's contempt decisions. Most notably, the Humboldt River one, which, unlike petitioner's counsel, is not completely a criminal contempt case. Yes, there was incarceration in the case, but of more importance to this argument here today, it involved the requirement of a posting of a $10,000 bond to ensure compliance with the particular water rights decrees that were at issue. The bond was challenged, and it was challenged under that portion of Chapter 22 that limits monetary recovery, to which the court responded, without discussing separation of powers or inherent powers, that the monetary limits of the particular bond in question here did not have to comply with Chapter 22 because it was aimed at civil coercion to compliance with the pre-existing order. Now, let's talk a little bit directly about McCormick. The petitioner also relies on AWOD. I think AWOD is quite clearly a criminal contempt case. A situation of litigation proceedings already concluded with a sealing order that was then subsequently violated by way of recording a property settlement agreement. The contempt citation there was clearly punishment. There was nothing to coerce compliance with at that point. The sealing order had already been violated. So you're dealing in A1 with clearly a criminal contempt proceedings. McCormick is much more difficult to analyze. The reason why it's more difficult to analyze, I suggest, raises at least three factual distinctions between what we're dealing with here today. The first one is factual. McCormick concerns the construction and maintenance of a dam, again a water rights case, many, many years earlier. It does not indicate in the report, clearly anyway, exactly what contempt sanction was being sought. The defendant's counsel characterized it as a civil contempt case, with monetary punishment being purely incidental. The court's report of the opinion quotes that characterization, does not agree with it, uses the word quasi-criminal at one point. But the point here that I think is needs to be noted by the court is that regardless of whether you do or do not call this a civil contempt case, it has nothing to do with ongoing judicial proceedings. And that's when the real separation of powers problem arises. Because it is that management and administration of ongoing judicial proceedings that the court has, particularly in recent years, increasingly protected by way of the separation of powers doctrine, as well as the inherent power doctrine. So the first distinction that you need to note is that you're dealing in the McCormick case with a factual circumstance which, even if it is a civil contempt proceeding, does not involve interference with judicial case management and administration. The second distinction is legal. McCormick relies quite extensively on the then existing statutory framework for the disqualification of judges. And it goes so far as to characterize that statutory framework as a public policy declaration by the legislature. And it uses that statutory framework with respect to disqualifying judges as a basis upon which for saying that the legislative intent or public policy statement reflected in NRS Chapter 22 can be applied to the circumstances in the court. Now, we all know that at this point in time, the disqualification of judges is now a matter of rule. Nevada Supreme Court rules, the canons of judicial conduct that have been adopted by this court. That moves the predicate for the Marshall decision from the legislative sphere to the judicial one. And the judicial sphere, obviously, is within the separation of powers parameters of the decisions, particularly the recent decisions of this court, which expressly note the judiciary's ability to control its own affairs by rule, as well as by order and by administrative practices adopted by the judiciary. The third point to note is something I've alluded to already before, and that is the fact that McCormick is decided against a background without significant separation of powers articulation. Virtually all of the decisions of this that have articulated what we now talk about amongst the current case law as separation of powers have come since Marshall, which was decided in 1950. The point of that is, whatever was the court's conception of the division of labor, or the division of authority, if you will, between the legislature and the judiciary in 1950, when Marshall has been cited, I respectfully suggest that this court, in a whole series of decisions, some of them relatively recent, have articulated a far, far broader scope for the judiciary's right to control its own administrative proceedings, including areas where traditionally the legislature has been allowed to act. Most recently, a majority of this court has decided that separation of powers reaches statutes dealing with the commencement of actions. That is a subject matter that has, at least until recent times, been left to the legislature, the judiciary assuming responsibility once an action has been commenced.
You're alluding to Berkson?
Yes, I am. But even prior to Berkson, you can run it all the way back through some aspects of the Hardcastle decision, some aspects of the other decisions, which recognize that when you are talking about handling the judiciary's business and administering the judicial business, that is within the judicial scope, and it is largely immune from legislative interference.
So would your argument invalidate the anti-SLAPP statute, for example?
Frankly, Your Honor, I hadn't thought about that. I don't think it invalidates.
How far does it go?
This court has addressed to what extent the anti-SLAPP statute is to be interpreted or applied more accurately. I still believe that statutes governing the commencement of actions are within the legislative sphere. It is a legislative recognition of the ability to invoke rights. Now, from that moment on, then it becomes a judicial question as to what the standards are, how they're interpreted, how they're decided. So I think to that extent, I think the anti-SLAPP statute survives. But I think the judiciary picks up immediately after the commencement of the action. And in this case, petitioner's counsel talks about the absence of a complaint, an answer, etc. When you're dealing with trust administrative judicial proceedings, you are dealing with an entirely different set of procedural filings. In this case, for example, this began with a petition for the trust to assume court to assume jurisdiction over the trust. That was followed by various proceedings attempting to enforce the beneficiary's right, the China Post number one and the American Allegiance right, to inspect and perforce to copy the trust documents. Not work product, and not anything covered by a retaining lien in favor of the client, the actual evidence on which the court's review of the trust must be based. And the notion that that somehow can be protected from disclosure by these various devices, I find startling to say the least. But in any case, when you get down to the question of enforcing rights to inspect and copy documents in the midst of trust proceedings, you're not just dealing with discovery, you're dealing with statutory rights of inspection, and more particularly, you are dealing with court administration at the very heart. And it would be absolutely chaotic, I respectfully suggest, to require that those kinds of decisions or enforcement of those kinds of decisions be transferred to a different judge, required complete familiarity with the proceedings again.
I have a follow-up
question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I do too when you're done.
Looking at McCormick, its language is quite broad in rejecting a constitutional challenge, the disqualification proviso in Chapter 22.
Yes.
Read literally, it would support Mr. Marshall's position that when he objected to Judge Kadish's participation, that objection should have been honored. Could you comment on whether it's fair to impose contempt in that setting, even if we were to agree with your reading of Chapter 22 in the more recent precedent and say, do you think that's fair, that in this case that should be applied to him in this proceeding?
Do you mean by Judge Kadish?
Let me clarify the question. Read literally, I think McCormick supports his position in this case that when he objected, he should have gotten another judge.
Yes.
Credit that reading for the sake of argument.
Right.
If we were to change that reading at your request, in this case, do you think it is fair to impose contempt sanctions on him when the law as it existed at the time this order was entered supported his position? And I recognize you're giving ground on that. I'm asking you to assume my reading of McCormick.
Well, again, even if McCormick was the law at that time, it was the law applied to a contempt proceeding having nothing to do with ongoing judicial and administrative action.
Yeah, I understand that. I understood that point. I'm asking.
So the only reason I'm quarreling about that is if you were to take the McCormick holding, and I'm not sure you can do this, but if you were to take the McCormick holding and apply it to a situation that it goes on in ongoing judicial proceedings, I still believe it is fair Because an honest, straightforward reading of McCormick would disclose that distinction on its face. And the subsequent cases, Humboldt River, the remaining cases that are cited in our petition, many of which just simply recognize the presiding judge's authority, and for that matter, give deference to it because of the presiding judge's familiarity, with no question being raised. So yes, I do think it would be fair because there's ample precedent that would indicate that McCormick's holding
is
would not apply in this situation.
Okay.
Justice Gibbons?
Mr. Frederick, on October 13, 2010, a temporary stay order was entered, signed by Justices Hardesty, Douglas, and Pickering of Judge Kadish's order. Is it your position that temporary stay order stopped the accrual of all of these $250 sanctions retroactively to the date they went into effect, or what's your feeling on this order here?
My reading of the order was it was a stay of proceedings. Now, obviously, that would mean any further contempt sanctions imposed. I think it also would be fair to assume that it would stop any sanctions based on noncompliance, because those would be a part of any further contempt proceedings. Obviously, our answer to the petition requests that stay be dissolved.
Right.
And so I think that the sanctions then would continue to exist. But in terms of the interim, I think it certainly would be fair to recognize that further contempt proceedings would be stayed, and that would include a compliance obligation for that period of time.
So how much time elapsed between when the sanctions went into effect at the $250 a day until October 13, 2010, to the best of your recollection? You didn't give me an estimate.
I think it was less than 2 weeks, frankly.
Okay. And Mr. Marshall can comment on that as well. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frederick. Mr. Marshall, rebuttal?
In response to your question, Justice Gibbons, my first objection to Judge Kadish was filed on September 27, and it was filed one day prior to court, which was held the next day. So and that is shown in tab one of my petition for an alternative writ of prohibition. I must say, I don't have any problem with 3.5 minutes because counsel has literally taken my breath away. What he's saying is that under the separation of powers doctrine, McCormick, AWOD at 90 Nevada, Rodriguez at 120 Nevada, and Brown at 101 Nevada, all are to be cast aside into the refuse basket, and we have a whole new theory of jurisprudence. And I have no problem with the separation of powers doctrine, but if you violate NRS 22.030 subsection 3 by saying that it violates the separation of powers, then you are obligated to provide a remedy because it leaves litigants without a remedy. The remedy when you have a biased judge is to file an objection. And if you say, no, that whole procedure is illegal under separation of powers, now where do people go? What can they do? They're left without a remedy. So I truly think that's a breathtaking issue that he's asking you to do. Finally, it is not a question of being protected from disclosure. The American Legion was contacted. They knew exactly what we were doing in defending the trust in the IR litigation. They are the ones who chose counsel because I called them and I said, look, I don't know anybody in Iowa. Do you know anybody? Surely in the American Legion, there's somebody who can recommend good counsel in Iowa. And they proceeded to get counsel in Iowa. They knew all about it. They knew what we were doing. They knew we were doing it. They could have come any time and said, we want to see your records. We want to know this. We want to know that. They were welcome at any time. As I've stated previously, there were 33 points of contact. Letters, correspondence, telephone calls over that period of 1 year where they were informed as to what was going on. And for them to say that, for them to blow into town like, literally, as I said in the brief, literally like Christ come to cleanse the temple. That's the way they presented themselves. And it was totally inexcusable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Thank you, Mr. Frederick.
This matter will stand submitted. The panel thanks both counsel for their argument, their professionalism, and their briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.